Thanks for downloading this History Hub podcast. For more information on History Hub and to download our other podcasts, go to historyhub.ie/podcasts. In this episode, The Anglo-Irish Treaty, Lecture 8 of Professor Michael Laffin's 10-lecture series on the Irish Revolution.
Well, this morning we reached the treaty, and I'm going to look at it today in some detail because it is one of the most important events in modern Irish history and has conditioned the history of independent Ireland ever since. Last week, we looked at the ways in which, on both sides, there was a readiness for an agreement, for a compromise. The British were demoralised by attacks, criticisms of them, not only external from other countries, but internal. Grave embarrassment on the part of very many British citizens, going up to the very top, to the King himself. On the Irish side, an inability to drive the British out, an awareness that while the IRA could carry on forever, as Mulcahy said, and I think I quoted this, he said later, we couldn't have driven the British out from anything more than a decent-sized police barracks. So both sides were by now, the summer of 1921, ready for the sort of compromise that Lloyd George was not prepared to accept 6 months earlier, at the end of 1920. There is, fortunately, an enormous literature on the treaty. You'll find it discussed and analysed in very many books, studies of the treaty, the foundation of the Irish Free State, the War of Independence, biographies, and so on. In old books like F.S.L. Lyons or Robert Key or Joseph Curran, there are accounts. There's one wonderful book which, if you can get hold of it, you should, and look at it. It's Thomas Jones, Whitehall Diary, Volume 3. I'll mention Jones later on today. The odds are that you won't be able to find it. It has a great rarity value. If you do, read it. It is an account by Lloyd George's gopher, to use an Irish term that might confuse the foreigners, the visiting students, Lloyd George's hatchet man, Lloyd George's agent in the treaty negotiations, who was involved at crucial stages and did what historians love historical characters to do. He wrote a diary. Historians love diaries. And Jones's diary is one of the most revealing of how important decisions are taken, how key negotiations are made or carried out. Okay, back now to the origins of the treaty. Negotiations took place in July. I mentioned last week De Valera's arrest and immediate release, a clear sign that things had changed since 6 months earlier, since the last serious attempt at a settlement. General Macready, the British Commander-in-Chief, negotiated with the IRA leaders. Ultimately, it was decided that at noon on the 11th of July, all fighting would stop. It is said, quite possibly truthfully, that when Macready went to the Mansion House in Dawson Street in Dublin to conclude the negotiations, observers could see clearly in the pocket of his trousers a revolver. He was expecting trouble. He was afraid that he might have to fight. There was no such conflict, no such disagreement, no such treachery. Both sides were by now, at least at the level of the leadership, anxious for a pause. Some IRA units wanted to carry on and saw absolutely no reason why they should stop fighting, but they all obeyed their orders. And with a few natural, almost inevitable blips here and there, the truce was observed by both sides until the treaty was concluded nearly 5 months later. Almost immediately, De Valera went to London and had four meetings with Lloyd George, just the two of them. De Valera went with a delegation, but nobody else, including Arthur Griffith, his deputy, who was let out of jail once the truce came into effect. It was one of the conditions of the truce. Nobody else was allowed to meet Lloyd George, and this was of great importance for the future. They negotiated hard. Lloyd George, as I've mentioned many times, a man of quite exceptional cunning and skill, Lloyd George played De Valera along as best he could. It happened by pure chance that then, in July 1921, an imperial conference was taking place in London. Prime ministers from the Dominions were meeting almost on a daily basis. And when Lloyd George brought de Valera into the cabinet room in Downing Street, he played a game. He left his hand drop, chair by chair, as he went around the table, saying, here this morning sat the Prime Minister of the Dominion of South Africa. Here the Prime Minister of the Dominion of Australia. Here the Prime Minister of the Dominion of Canada, and so on. And then he let his hand drop on one particular chair and said nothing, waiting for de Valera to ask the obvious question, who sat there? De Valera didn't. So Lloyd George had to ask or answer the question that he hadn't quite put. And this is reserved for the Prime Minister of the Dominion of Southern Ireland. Dominion. That was a vastly greater status than had ever been contemplated before. Remember, just the previous year, in 1920, what could be called the Fourth Home Rule Bill came into law, the Government of Ireland Act, which granted both parts of Ireland, 6 and 26 counties, exactly what had been on offer to the whole of Ireland before, Home Rule, a subordinate parliament. Now, at the very beginning of the negotiations, Lloyd George was prepared to offer Dominion status, equality with Canada, Australia, New Zealand, with details to be worked out and negotiated, of course, but basic equality. And it's important to remember that Dominion status was not something fixed and solid and frozen. Dominion status was something fluid and mobile. It was changing over time. It had changed dramatically in the less than 3 years since the end of the war. The Dominions were, step by step, stage by stage, becoming fully independent nations. They had all signed, for example, the Treaty of Versailles just 2 years earlier. To use an image that wouldn't have been current then, Dominion status was like standing on an escalator which moved upwards. One didn't need to do anything. One advanced automatically. And there was a degree of automatic increase of independence involved in Dominion status. Lloyd George was prepared to offer that. Lloyd George, in the bantering, the negotiations that took place, he may have lost that round. De Valera didn't fall into the trap. But Lloyd George won another significant round. Like any good lawyer, he didn't ask a question unless he already knew the answer. So, at one stage in their meetings, he held up a sheet of paper, one of De Valera's letters to him, responding to the invitation to negotiate. And he looked at it and said, ah, here we have, in your language, in Irish, the words, Ser Stort Nehir. What does that mean? And De Valera said, it means the Republic of Ireland. No, Lord George said, no, what does it mean literally? The Irish Free State. Very interesting. No more was said, no more needed to be said. Lloyd George stored that up. The words Free State had now been used between them. De Valera went back to Dublin. Long and acrimonious negotiations continued by letter, backwards and forwards across the Irish Sea. And De Valera was in no hurry at all to begin serious negotiations, for the simple reason that it was midsummer. There was no fighting. He wanted to ensure that if there were to be a breakdown, if fighting were to be resumed, it would not be resumed in midsummer or early autumn. For a guerrilla army, winter is the better, the dark winter is the time to fight, not summer. The longer any fighting could be postponed until a time of year suitable to the IRA, the better. And there was a second reason why De Valera was in no hurry. In Ireland, things were going very much his way. Under the terms of the truce, the British forces, the police and the army, couldn't interfere with ordinary activities of the IRA. Of course there would be no killing, no attacks, no ambushes. But Sinn Féin and the Dáil would be able to carry on. They could resume their legal system. The Dáil courts could be reassembled. they could consolidate their control over local government. And one exasperated police county inspector remarked that they, that is the Irish, the Doyle, Sinn Féin, the IRA, are carrying on exactly as before, except that the killing has stopped. Large numbers of young men were recruited or conscripted into the volunteers, which were reformed. And the Doyle, Sinn Féin and the IRA between them were now consolidating their control over large parts of Southern Ireland. The British couldn't stop them under the terms of the truce. So much so that when the British made their own plans for what would happen if negotiations broke down and if the war resumed, they said, we cannot fight the war as it has been fought until noon on the 11th of July. We'd have to fight in a different way because the Doyle, the enemy, De Valera and his group control most of Ireland by now. What we'll do is we'll hold Dublin and starve the rest of the country. We'll blockade it. We'll have to abandon control over pretty well all of Ireland and force them into surrender in a different way from the way that we had tried to do it until the truce came into effect. Eventually, in October, it was agreed that negotiations would begin. There were a few false starts. Lloyd George, as a patriotic Welshman, almost always took his summer holidays in Wales. It just happened that in 1921 he took them in the Highlands of Scotland, and he thought the Highlands were really rather nice. Why not hold a peace conference in Inverness? Neutral, far from London, far from Dublin. His London-based colleagues were appalled at the idea. Going up to Scotland for a holiday in midsummer was possibly acceptable, but to spend possibly weeks stuck in a small Scottish town was utterly unbearable, and there was a cabinet revolt against the idea, and a summit meeting in Inverness was scrapped. The meeting would be held in London. The negotiations would take place in Lloyd George's house, the Prime Minister's house in 10 Downing Street. And the Irish accepted Lloyd George's invitation to negotiations, and the wording ran, to ascertain how the association of Ireland with the community of nations known as the British Empire can best be reconciled with Irish national aspirations. An Irish team was sent over to London, and the negotiations lasted nearly 2 months, from the 11th of October to the 6th of December. The best known negative fact in Irish history is that De Valera didn't go. Why? It was a fact of enormous significance in the light of what was to follow. Various reasons were given. His attitude at one level was, I am a president. Mr. Lloyd George is a mere prime minister. Presidents don't negotiate with prime ministers. There was, of course, the recent and from a president's point of view, unfortunate experience of the Paris Peace Conference in 1990, when an American president had gone to Paris to negotiate with Georges Clemenceau and Lloyd George. And Woodrow Wilson, poor, innocent, naive man, was tricked and deceived by Lloyd George time after time, who wrapped the president around his little finger. And that was an example of why perhaps a president, or at least President Wilson, shouldn't negotiate with a prime minister, at least Lloyd George. But there were other reasons why De Valera was unwilling to go. Remember, as I said already, he was the only Irish leader who had met Lloyd George. And Lloyd George had a deserved reputation for skill and cunning. And as things were to turn out, though, of course, nobody could have known this at the time, the Irish negotiations would be Lloyd George's masterpiece. There he was clever, even beyond his own very, very, very high standards. De Valera argued that he, the president, was associated with a hard line, which wasn't necessarily true. The British thought Collins was far tougher, far more extreme than De Valera. But he said, if a delegation is sent to London, headed by Mr. Griffith, a known, a famous moderate, and negotiations fail, then it will be clear to everybody in Ireland that the British were totally unreasonable. If even Mr. Griffith couldn't agree with them, then they must have dug their heels in. So let Mr. Griffith head the delegation, and let Mr. Collins go with him to provide some backbone. It would be easier under those circumstances to arouse the Irish public to a resumption of war. De Valera, if he stayed behind, could work on the extremists in his cabinet, people like Austin Stack and Cathal Brewer. De Valera had told the Dáil, not long before, "We are not Republican doctrinaires." But he knew that some of his colleagues were Republican doctrinaires, and they might listen to him in a way that they wouldn't listen to others. He told the Dáil that he had more useful work to do in Ireland than in London. And it was decided that no agreement would be reached in London without it being referred back to the cabinet in Dublin. Now, that is important and also, I'm afraid, complicated, because members of the cabinet also belonged to the treaty delegation in London: Griffith, Collins and Barton. Three of the seven members of the cabinet were in London. Four members were back in Dublin. In practice, what private, secret instructions given to the delegation were amounted to the four members of the cabinet back in Dublin, De Valera, Stack, Brewer and Cosgrave, having the final word. And they, who weren't involved in the negotiations at all, would say yes or no to a proposed agreement reached in London by the other three members of the cabinet. It is said by De Valera's critics, and as you know, he has very many critics, he is the most controversial figure in 20th century Irish history. It is said by his critics that he was afraid of Lloyd George. He was afraid of Lloyd George's skill and cunning and duplicity. And he needed to put the whole width of England and Wales and the Irish Sea between Lloyd George and himself. That anybody who got close to Lloyd George would be caught and trapped in the spider's web. And there's one particularly revealing conversation that illustrates exactly how Lloyd George was feared. De Valera, before he went to London in July, very sensibly had meetings with different sorts of people: home rulers, unionists, to get their views. After all, he was supposedly going to represent the whole of the Irish people. And one of the people he met was Lord Middleton from County Cork, former British cabinet minister, prominent British politician who knew Lloyd George. And Middleton said to De Valera, "Mr. De Valera, you are going to negotiate with Mr. Lloyd George. You must be a very brave man." Everybody knew that Lloyd George was the most skillful negotiator in Europe. He had proved it time after time after time. So any agreement could not be an agreement reached by people who had been caught in his spell. He was known as the Welsh Wizard. He cast spells on people. He was charming. He was very, very clever. So the agreement would have to be ratified by people who had nothing to do with him and could not have been mesmerised by him. Another reason, a final one, of course, the final one, is that De Valera and many others felt the negotiations would probably fail. In their meetings in July, Lloyd George had told De Valera, "You are not going to get a republic. That's that. If you look for a republic, negotiations are over. It's out of the question." With the result, the Irish never asked for a republic. They knew it was gone. It wasn't on the agenda. If they mentioned it, war. It would be unthinkable, a total, utter surrender by the British to concede an Irish republic. So that was out. Yet there were many elements in Sinn Féin and the IRA determined on a republic. The Irish were expected to get in the negotiations what they couldn't get. There was going to be trouble. De Valera didn't want to be involved in what was likely to be a failure. So he stayed behind. His decision provoked controversy. One member of the cabinet, Cosgrave, his later deadly enemy throughout the 1920s, remarked that we are going to play a match leaving our best player in reserve. Why not play with your best performer? The only one of the Irish leadership who had ever met Lloyd George. Perhaps it was precisely because he had met Lloyd George that he was determined not to go. Collins was, as I mentioned already, still seen as an extremist. Yet he was forced to go by De Valera. He didn't want to. In early 1921, the British regarded De Valera as a puppet, with Collins as the puppeteer pulling the strings. Ironic in the light of the way in which the treaty turned out. It was ominous for the Irish that despite Collins's presence in the delegation, despite his relative extremism, his commitment to a republic, the delegation was weighted in favour of moderates. Griffith, down-to-earth, practical man, whose aim had all along, until just a few years before, until 1917, been a dual monarchy, was now looking for vastly more than that, representing fairly and honestly, as best he could, the consensus of his colleagues. But others, back in Dublin, Brewer and Stack, represented the almost abstract republicanism, the messianism, the extremism associated with many of the elements in the Irish nationalist movement, the republican elements that I've looked at, I've examined already in an earlier lecture. Griffith and, as it turned out, Collins were, at the end of the day, moderates. So was Eamon Duggan, another member of the delegation. Opposed to them were Robert Barton and George Gavan Duffy, and non-voting, Erskine Childers, the secretary. But these elements were not a serious counterweight to the heavyweights on the delegation, Griffith and Collins. While back in Dublin, the cabinet was weighted, or the rump cabinet, those who were not involved in the negotiations, were weighted in favour of the extremists, with Brewer and Stack on one side, Cosgrave on another, and De Valera somewhere in between, ultimately, to the surprise of many, coming down on the extremist side. De Valera later told the Doyle that the delegation wasn't quite the one he would have liked to have sent, but there might have been personal differences between members of the cabinet which would prevent them from working as a team. So the Republican faction dominated the cabinet at home, the moderate faction dominated the delegation in London. Personalities were important. Since 1917, since the October Convention, when the party was united under De Valera, I haven't needed to examine them in great detail. But there's no escaping them now. For 4 years, between late 1917 and late 1921, there was a surprising degree of harmony and unity on the Irish side. The Volunteers, the IRA's suspicion of Sinn Féin, an extreme example of which was Collins's distrust of Griffith, was now gone. De Valera was a leader that everyone was prepared to work under. While he was away, between June 1919 and Griffith's arrest in November 1920, there was, in the light of what had happened already, a surprising degree of harmony between Griffith, the moderate, and Collins, the extremist. When De Valera returned, the things were slightly strained because Collins had grown enormously in stature and power during De Valera's 18 months' absence. Nonetheless, they cooperated. Collins accepted straight away that De Valera was the boss, and De Valera, surprised at how much power had been amassed by Collins, tried to modify, to undermine that. But De Valera nonetheless respected Collins's efficiency. And Collins, in turn, respected De Valera's judgment. But there were difficulties. As I think I mentioned already, Collins had quarrelled, sometimes bitterly, with both Brewer and Stack, and they were close to De Valera. On his return to the United from the United States, on his return to Ireland, De Valera, amazingly, suggested that Collins should go to the United States to to represent Ireland in his place. Collins wouldn't have that at all. He knew he was far too important to be sent on that sort of mission. And as he said, with characteristic bluntness, the long poor won't get rid of me that easily. A sign of trouble to come. It's significant that when Griffith, who had been acting president, was arrested, his successor as acting president, until De Valera returned, just a matter of weeks later, was Collins. When De Valera was arrested, as it turned out only for a few hours, at the end of June 1921, his successor was Alston Stack, not Collins. By late 1921, there were suspicions, if not outright animosities, between Collins on the one hand and Stack and Brewer on the other, each side wanting to get De Valera's support. And in the crucial months, October to December 1921, Brewer and Stack had daily access to De Valera. Collins saw him on his very rare visits to Dublin. Officially, the delegates were described as plenipotentiaries. The dictionary definition of that word, the Oxford dictionary, is a person invested with full power, especially as ambassador, deputed to act at discretion. Yet in September, De Valera told the Doyle that he understood the word plenipotentiary to mean people who had power to deal with a question subject to ratification, which is a definition unknown to any dictionary I've ever come across. Nonetheless, the delegates were described officially as plenipotentiaries to give the world the impression that they were sent with full powers, that they were an equal team, equal to the British. It was understood, as a result of their private instructions, that they would refer any agreement reached back to the cabinet in Dublin. Of course, it went without saying that both sides would have to submit an agreement to their respective parliaments, the Houses of Lords and Commons in London, the Doyle in Dublin. That was taken for granted. But the question, the key question was, could each delegation sign an agreement without having to go back to a full cabinet? On the British side, that was taken for granted. On the Irish side, there was confusion. The delegates were also given another instruction. If a break came, if the negotiations collapsed, the break should come on the question of Ulster, of partition. That was an emotive issue which would arouse the Irish people and make it easier to win them over to the idea of resuming the war. But it was not what mattered most to the Irish leadership. They were far less concerned with partition, with the North, than they were with sovereignty, with status, with the degree of independence that whatever part of Ireland would become independent would achieve. As I've said already, they knew there was going to be no question of a republic. That was out. They wanted, however, to reduce, diminish, obliterate the role of the king, to have the king as vague, as vestigial, as meaningless as possible, a figure in any future Irish state. That was important. That mattered most to the leadership. The question of full sovereignty, of the avoidance of any significant degree of attachment to connection with the crown. That was what mattered most to them. To an extent, Ulster, or partition, was a smokescreen. It was a secondary aim which would be put in a prominent position if the negotiations failed, but it was not their main concern. It was, however, the main concern when compared with the question of sovereignty and the rule of the king. It was the main concern of the Irish people. In that respect, the Irish leadership did not represent the Irish people, which was to be a serious weakness in their case. They had different priorities from the mass of their followers, and that would condition the events of 1922, of the treaty split. On the Irish side, the negotiations were characterised by tension between the delegates as a whole and the cabinet, or the rest of the cabinet in Dublin, and also within the delegation. This is symbolised, perhaps misleadingly, by the crucial decision taken at the very end on the 6th of December not to telephone De Valera, not to consult him when presented effectively with an ultimatum, but to decide by themselves. And while the negotiations lasted, De Valera concentrated on keeping in close touch with Brewer and Stack, his fellow cabinet ministers, and lost touch with the delegation. Griffith, of course, wrote him daily letters informing him of what was going on. But when he tried to interfere, he was told, "We are the delegates, please don't give us detailed, precise directions and instructions." And when De Valera conjured up an image of the future relationship between Ireland and Britain, or Ireland and the Empire, his image was one of external association. There would be no escaping the crown. The king would have to be written into the treaty. They knew that. How to make the king utterly powerless, effectively meaningless. And he said, rather than have two circles, the British Empire and Ireland within it, that would be internal association. Let there be external association. Two circles touching at one point. The point would be the king. They would otherwise be quite separate. The Irish would recognise the king in some form as head of an association, but he would not be head of Ireland. He would not be king of Ireland. They couldn't get their republic, they knew that. But at least they could prevent Ireland from being a monarchy in the way that Canada, Australia, and New Zealand were monarchs sharing the same king with Britain. The delegates failed to realise that this was as far as De Valera was prepared to go. He wouldn't accept anything beyond external association. Within the delegation in London, Griffith and Collins took over the leading role and marginalised their colleagues, some of whom they despised, and perhaps with good reason. The three main issues in the negotiations, and I'm not going to go through them day by day, week by week, I'll just deal with the broad outlines of the discussions. Three main issues. The first, surprisingly minor and uncontroversial, were military and naval. The Irish accepted, quite reasonably, that Britain had strategic defence interests that would have to be recognised. And if Ireland were to break away from the United Kingdom, British security would have to be guaranteed. The Royal Navy would want and be given certain facilities. Ultimately, that resulted in the treaty ports, which would be controlled by the Royal Navy. Erskine Childers was deeply unhappy about that, but on both sides, pro and anti-treaty, there was appreciation that here, British demands and concerns were eminently reasonable. The second, much more important, and I'm going up the scale of importance from minor to major, in between, the middle one, was Ulster. And there the Irish wanted what they called essential unity. They were prepared to make very considerable concessions to Ulster. Remember, and this is a crucial fact, remember, partition was already in force. The Government of Ireland Act of December 1920 had partitioned Ireland in two. Elections had taken place for a Northern Irish Parliament. That Parliament had chosen a government headed by Sir James Craig. That government was now operating, implementing Home Rule for Northern Ireland. You will still, I'm afraid, and it is a matter of deep shame, you will still find ignorant Irish people, and Irish Americans too, sometimes vastly more ignorant than the Irish in Ireland, who say that the treaty caused partition. You can say, whenever you hear this rubbish, you can say with total confidence, it is rubbish. It is garbage. We historians are prisoners of chronology. If A happened before B, then B did not cause A. That is the way historians' minds work. Partition was established before De Valera went to London, let alone before the delegates went to London in October. Partition was established before the treaty negotiations began. Therefore, the treaty did not cause partition. It might have consolidated it. That's another matter. It didn't cause it. So partition was an established fact before the treaty negotiations began. The Irish reasonably took the view, okay, we'll accept this fact. Let the Northern Irish Parliament and government continue. Except they will hold their powers under us in Dublin, not under London. totally unacceptable to the Unionists, but a sign that the Irish accepted existing realities. The British were aware that Ulster partition was the weak link in their argument. After all, the British, and I think I mentioned this already, had been determined that there would be no consultation of the people of Ulster involved. Partition would be imposed by drawing a line on the map. 6 counties here, 26 counties there. Laid down from above. No European, no continental-style referenda or plebiscites has happened in Silesia, in Schleswig and other parts of Europe. Referenda were for defeated countries. Victorious countries didn't subject their citizens, their populations, to any nonsense about consultation. But the result was that one-third of the population of Northern Ireland hated Northern Ireland, wanted to get out, wanted to end the state. That the minority in Northern Ireland, the nationalist Catholic minority, was considerably larger than the Unionist Protestant minority in the island as a whole. So there was massive injustice. 2 counties and 1 city, Tyrone, Fermanagh and Derry City, had Catholic majorities. So the British appreciated that their position in Ulster was weak. As Lloyd George remarked in a private meeting of the British cabinet, men, and of course he was referring to British people, men will die for the throne and the empire. I do not know who will die for Tyrone and Fermanagh. There we have a very weak case. And Austin Chamberlain, the leader of the Conservative Party, the Deputy Prime Minister, remarked, the 6 counties is a compromise, and like all compromises, is illogical and indefensible. You could not raise an army in England to fight for that, as you could for the Crown and the Empire. And in the negotiations, the Irish naturally took the view, Northern Ireland is unjust, undemocratic, one-third of the population want out, you must respond to that, you must adjust the border. As Lloyd George, as Griffith put it in a discussion with Lloyd George, it is exactly as if 5 or 6 socialist counties in England cut themselves off from under a Tory government they disliked. In October, at a private meeting of the British delegation, with no Irish people present to overhear them, it was pointed out that the Irish had asked, as they left a meeting, why could we not allow county option? And remember, that had been part of the packages proposed back in 1914. Chamberlain said they could not put a more difficult question. And Lord Birkenhead, another member of the British delegation, said, our position regarding the 6 counties is an impossible one. If these men want to settle, as they do, the British knew that they were on a dodgy, that they were on dodgy ground on the question of partition. And the key development came in early November in private meetings between Lloyd George and Tom Jones, whose diaries I've mentioned, who acted often as Lloyd George's agent, and Arthur Griffith. Incidentally, you must, of course, and I've told you this before, you must never, ever, ever refer to England when you mean Britain. It is a gross blunder. It is deeply offensive to Scots and Welsh people, and why should one want to offend them? And at the time that I'm talking about, the Prime Minister of Great Britain was a Welsh-speaking Welshman. Tom Jones was also a Welsh-speaking Welshman. And the pair of them enjoyed carrying on private conversations in the company of Englishmen and Irishmen. They enjoyed carrying on conversations in Welsh, knowing that nobody else in the room would understand them. And also knowing that the Irish delegates couldn't speak Irish, and that therefore they were able to show, we are far more Celtic than you. We represent a country with a different language. Your country might have a different language, but you don't speak it. Mr. Jones and I, we speak Welsh perfectly. Lloyd George would enjoy from time to time saying, we Celts, you Irish, we Welsh, we understand each other. The English, God help us, a troublesome lot. Which was, of course, part of his way of using charm and to use an Irish term, plomos, to undermine the self-confidence of the Irish delegation. But between them, Lloyd George and Jones had a series of meetings with Arthur Griffith, in which they pointed out that the Conservative Party was due to have its annual conference. There was going to be a massive attack on the treaty negotiations by Conservatives who opposed any concession. Bonar Law, until recently the leader of the Conservative Party, and he would be soon again, but he was now in retirement, short-term retirement, Bonar Law was expected to lead an attack on Chamberlain, his successor as party leader. How to prevent that attack undermining the government and wrecking the negotiations? And Lloyd George and Tom Jones turned to Griffith and said, help us. Make it possible for us to carry on talking with you. Don't pull the rug from under our feet. The result will be the collapse of the negotiations. We will have to do something to reassure British Conservatives that the Ulster Unionists will not be abandoned. How to do that? We can't simply hand them over to you. What about a boundary commission? Re-examine the border. The result, of course, will be to give you very large areas. A third, half of the area of Northern Ireland. That goes without saying. So, if you agree to that, will you promise not to break the negotiations on the question of Ulster? And, unwisely, perhaps naively, Griffith fell into Lloyd George's trap. I told you Lloyd George is a clever man. And he said, yes, I will not let you down on that. If you agree to a boundary commission that will re-examine the border, then we will not break off the negotiations on the question of Ulster. And that, of course, was precisely what Lloyd George wanted. He wanted to avoid a break on the question of Ulster. And, of course, the Irish had been determined that if a break came, it would be on the question of Ulster. And now, as a result of this private conversation, which, and somebody said Griffith signed a document, he signed nothing. The next day, Tom Jones showed him a draft account of the agreement. Griffith looked at it and said, yes, yes, that's fine. That was as far as it went. But Griffith was now compromised. He had effectively given his word that he would not bring about a break over the Ulster negotiation. From then on, Lloyd George was confident. At the very least, he could break the Irish delegation in two. He had the leader of the Irish delegation in his hands, in his pocket. The break would not come from at least a united Irish delegation on the question of Ulster, which is what he had wanted to avoid. The last and most important of the three main issues was the question of the crown, the king. Enormously important for both delegations. It may seem bizarre to us now to think of a monarchist ideology. We understand a republican ideology, that makes perfect sense. But why should people, apart from readers of Hello magazine and sort of trashy journals like that, why should people revere the monarchy? There was a great reverence for the monarchy, even if the king at the time, George V, was a particularly dull, dim man. But still, he was revered and the royal family was revered. There was also a feeling that if the monarch were to be sidelined or abandoned, it would symbolise Ireland's total withdrawal from the British Empire, not only the breakup of the United Kingdom, but the collapse, or the beginning of the end of the empire, and that must not be allowed. So the British insisted the king must be there, the crown must be written into any agreement. And the Irish were equally determined that while they couldn't get a republic, they weren't going to have a monarchy either. Griffith, of course, didn't share the sentimental, ideological commitment to a republic felt by his colleagues like De Valera and Collins, but nonetheless he argued very strongly and honourably against any excessive inclusion of the king in an agreement. Remember, the Irish never looked for a republic. It had been made clear they wouldn't get it. Nobody, De Valera, didn't suggest they should demand it. It was just out of the question. The aim was to get rid of the king, any reference to the king. And external association was De Valera's aim, not dominion status that would bring Ireland inside the empire, not attached to it from outside. And remember what I said a few minutes ago, dominion status was something fluid, it was flexible, it was mobile, it was constantly changing. And Some members of the Irish leadership, such as Griffith and Collins, appreciated that. Others did not. Griffith made it clear to Lloyd George in a letter, if we are satisfied on other points, we will recognise the King as head of the association and join in free partnership with the Commonwealth. But this was to be from outside, not inside. But the delegates were less concerned with the question of the crown than were the rest of the cabinet back in Dublin. In that sense, the delegates were much more in tune with Irish public opinion, which was more concerned with Ulster and partition, not with abstract questions of the crown. Ultimately, and I'm skipping all the details, you can find them in lots of books. Ultimately, at the end of November, the British presented the Irish with a draft treaty. This was brought back to Dublin and discussed by the full cabinet, delegates and non-delegates. The delegates said to their colleagues, these are the best terms we can get. We must accept the crown in some form or other. And there will have to be some sort of allegiance to the crown. Griffith said he would not accept responsibility of resuming the war simply on the question of the crown. Brewer said, rather nastily, the British cabinet has selected its men, referring to the fact that Griffith and Collins had had private meetings with Lloyd George. De Valera, and he's reported in the cabinet minutes in the third person, De Valera said, he might understand Mr. Griffith giving up independence for national unity, but you've got neither this nor that. So the cabinet rejected the draft treaty. There was to be no oath of allegiance. And Griffith assured the cabinet that no agreement would be reached in London until it had been referred back to Dublin. The delegates then went back to London for a last round of discussion. There were 2 days of lengthy negotiations. The oath to be taken by all members of the Dáil was revised. An oath of allegiance, and allegiance involves obedience, recognition of somebody's superiority, an old medieval term. The oath of allegiance was removed. It was replaced by a different oath, whereby members of the Dáil said they would be faithful to His Majesty King George V and so on. Faithful, and they would swear allegiance to the Constitution, but not allegiance to the King. So in that sense, the delegates obeyed the cabinet order. There would be no oath of allegiance. Lloyd George said, and it's often held against him, that if the negotiations now failed, there would be terrible, immediate and terrible war. Couldn't be immediate, there had to be 3 days' notice, but effectively immediate. Some Irish people take the view, how could he do that? What a terrible thing to say. This was bullying. I can never understand that argument. To me, it is the most obvious thing in the world that if negotiations failed, war would resume. That's what happens. If there's a truce and it breaks down, war starts again. That happens all over the world. But when Lloyd George said it, it was felt to be highly improper, and still is felt by some Irish people to have been highly improper. To me, it just seems a sensible, logical, if tough, negotiating tactic. And then, with partly accidental, brilliant timing, Lloyd George produced a bit of paper. Mr. Griffith, here is the record of our discussion of a month ago. You said you would not break on Ulster if there was to be a boundary commission. Griffith had totally forgotten it. Lloyd George had rather embarrassingly lost the letter. And in Downing Street, flunkies were sent to examine all the pockets of all his clothes, his desk, everywhere, to find that scrap of paper. They found the scrap of paper. Griffith's signature wasn't on it, but Griffith remembered the discussion. Collins, the others, had never heard of this private agreement that Griffith had regarded just as a private chat. And Griffith, being a man of honour, said, yes, Mr. Prime Minister, I gave you that undertaking, I will observe it. I at least will sign a treaty, even if nobody else does, because we have been satisfied on all other points, and I will not break on the question of Ulster if there is to be a boundary commission, which has been agreed. The other Irish delegates were appalled, but they couldn't abandon Griffith. Discussions continued. Lloyd George, at that stage, with brilliant timing, made massive concessions. You want the right for full economic independence? Fine. You want to raise tariffs against British goods? Fine. Grant. You can have all those. Anything you like. But the King must be there. We must have the King written in. So Ireland would be inside, not outside the empire. Ireland would be a dominion, not a state associated with the other dominions through external association. And the Irish delegates signed. They didn't ring De Valera to get his agreement. First of all, they didn't know where he was. With perhaps unwise or perhaps very cunning timing, De Valera was unavailable. He was somewhere in Limerick. They didn't know where he was. And in any case, it would be impossible to carry on a private telephone conversation with De Valera. The British would naturally eavesdrop, and every word would be reported back to Lloyd George. They acted as if they were plenipotentiaries. Officially, they were plenipotentiaries. The Doyle had described them as such. The cabinet hadn't. They signed with varying degrees of reluctance. And on the 6th of December 1921, agreement was reached on the treaty.
We hope you enjoyed this History Hub podcast. You can find many other podcasts on our website at historyhub.ie/podcasts.